not seen anything in that area, but that's not to say, like you're saying, there's something out there.
Yeah, I can only see it. I got night vision goggles on. I can only see it through the goggles.
Oh, that's awesome.
News, science, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, fresh back off the road and spending some time in the southeast with some of my favorite people over St. Patrick's Day weekend studying the ancient past. And so now that I'm back in the bunker, it's time to get back to business, and we have plenty of that to discuss tonight, including news about a meteor blast that occurred over the Bering Sea. These, of course, are always of interest to me. More on that in a moment. We also have forensic investigation of a shawl that may be linked to one of the most famous serial killers of all time. We also have something very unique that has turned up on a remote island. Geologists are calling this a true mystery. And I want to ask, why does the Pentagon want to test a space-based weapon in the next few years? We also have a mystery object that was spotted over Arizona. This is big news. Mystery cats that may have been observed in the southeast, which we recently discussed on this program, believed to be extinct. And then later in the program, a good friend of mine, George Howard, is going to be joining me because I have to touch base with him about big news that broke while the Seven Ages team and I were down south. Yeah, this is something a lot of us are excited about. We actually were able to spend some time with one of the authors of this paper while we were in South Carolina, and that individual was also the lead author on a very important paper that came out in 2017 that identified a mysterious platinum anomaly found in various different proxies from parts of the world. But he's a co-author on a recent paper that discusses new discoveries in South America that are expanding the reach of the ever-enigmatic Younger Dryas and the possible implications of an impact that occurred in relation to that. We talk about that subject a lot on the Seven Ages show, and we're going to be spending some time on that on a future episode with little doubt. But I think it's only proper, with the science focus I try to take on this show, to bring that subject over onto this program from time to time. And of course, on the heels of our discussion recently with Randall Carlson, I think this has been on a lot of folks' minds. But, you know, more importantly, and this is something George and I, we caught up and had dinner a while back. It was sometime, I guess, late last year. And he had said, you know, Micah, I think one of the most respectable things that you could actually do, you and your team, is to focus on that catastrophism element to all this. And a lot of people, I think, kind of play down the idea of catastrophism, or essentially in the ancient world, that there were big changes that occurred in a little amount of time as a result of catastrophic events. But, I mean, there is plenty of evidence that shows that this kind of thing has happened and what kinds of devastation occurs when it does. Best example, I think, is, of course, the extinction of the dinosaurs. But in the broader sense of the discussion of asteroids, comets, impacts with Earth, and the kind of changes that can occur when something like this happens, I think it's really important to remember a few things. I mean, asteroids are appealing to us because of the precious metals that they contain, and this is the very reason why some, including our friend Dr. Christopher Moore, have linked a platinum anomaly found at the Younger Dryas boundary. They link that to a possible extraterrestrial impact, and that's just it. These rare earth elements are called that because they don't appear in abundance on Earth. And so when under certain circumstances you find a lot of them, it seems to indicate, again, for lack of a better term, an extraterrestrial source. And this is the very reason why, in the future, we hope to be able to mine asteroids, because there are a lot of precious resources we may be able to glean from those space rocks. So while there are some benefits to our interactions with asteroids, comets, and the like, we are, of course, also posed with certain threats by these, and not just the fact that they may eventually impact the Earth. Recent studies, for instance, have shown that it may be much harder to actually dismantle an asteroid before it strikes the Earth. And most of you guys, I'm sure, remember the film Armageddon, right? And what they did, they go up there and they actually land on an asteroid on its way toward Earth. They drop a nuke, and then they dismantle this thing before it hits the Earth. Well, according to new models, it will take more firepower in order to do that. And the question I would have is, even if you break apart an asteroid and it's broken into several smaller pieces, One of the problems you face then is the possibility that those smaller fragments may actually be dispersed and strike several locations on Earth. Which is better? Several small asteroids or shards of an asteroid striking Earth in different places and causing widespread damage, or one big one smashing into the Earth and we get a second moon and all life on planet Earth is destroyed? I guess it turns into one of those 6-to-1, half a dozen and other things. But it is important to note that as we are putting together models about how we may offset the catastrophic effects of asteroids, and also keeping in mind that there are no known dangers from space rocks large enough to pose that kind of threat that are headed to Earth within the next century, so we've got a little time to work on this. I'm sure that these models will also incorporate factors like, well, how do we prevent smaller fragments from continuing on their path toward Earth? We've got to be able to set those off course too. So again, I don't take for granted that science looks at all the range of possibilities in dealing with threats like this. And it's not that I want people to go around looking at the sky, you know, building bunkers beneath their homes and living in fear. It's just that this is something I think that history has shown, well, prehistory has shown, that we have to take seriously. And that's why I'm a little concerned by the fact that people don't take more seriously the possibility and the science that backs that possibility that there was something that happened around 12,800 years ago for which we now have evidence on 4 different continents. And of course, George and I are going to get into that a little later, but I want to share a news story with you along these lines. The Guardian reported the other day that there was a meteor blast over the Bering Sea that was an estimated 10 times the blast at Hiroshima at the end of the Second World War. They say the fireball tore across the sky of Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula on 18th of December and released energy equivalent to 173 kilotons of TNT. It was, the Guardian reports, the largest air blast since another meteor hurtled into the atmosphere over Chelyabinsk in Russia's southwest 6 years ago, and the second largest in the past 30 years. Now, again, this is important because we have to look at the fact that nobody even hardly noticed this because of where in the sky this air burst occurred, and that, as it sounds, means that the meteor completely broke apart and burned up before it ever struck the ground. But in the past, and this is something that must be taken into consideration, we know that there have been similar air bursts that can nonetheless cause very widespread devastation. Again, at the time of the Chelyabinsk event, NASA and other space agencies had been observing another object that was passing near Earth. You may remember, it was called asteroid 2012 DA14. It flew as close as 28,000 kilometers from Earth. Now, current evidence does not link it with the Chelyabinsk meteor. There have been people who have suggested to me that they find it very unusual that the two occurred in such close proximity to one another, and that at very least a link may be possible. I can't name those people for various reasons here and now, but I can certainly say that they are experts in their field. But I do want to quote a few authors of an article that appeared in Skeptical Inquirer back in 2013, David Morrison, Alan Harris, and Mark Boslow, who is an expert on airbursts, and also he's a real critic of the Unger-Drice impact hypothesis. But nonetheless, with his expertise in this, he said, with a diameter of about 20 meters, the Chelyabinsk impactor was smaller than most asteroids that have been detected by the telescopes of the NASA Space Guard Survey, which focuses on finding asteroids of about 100 meters or larger. That's why they couldn't spot this. And again, they say that they think it was unrelated. But I want to point out that evidence already shows it doesn't require an object 100 meters or larger, which is at that threshold that's easily spotted. It doesn't take an object that big to cause widespread devastation. And the meteor, again, that they were talking about in the Guardian piece, didn't do that. That airburst didn't cause that kind of devastation. But a slightly larger one back in 1908 that was also an airburst incident certainly did. And that, of course, was the Tunguska blast. That object was believed to have been about 120 feet across, which isn't very big and certainly not large enough to be easily detected. But it destroyed 800 square miles of forest over remote Siberia. There were an estimated 80 million trees flattened, and according to NASA, I want to share a quote here from one of their pages on the Tunguska incident. They say, it is estimated the asteroid entered Earth's atmosphere traveling at a speed of about 33,500 miles per hour. During its quick plunge, the 220 million pound space rock heated the air surrounding it to 44,500 degrees Fahrenheit. At 7:17 a.m. local Siberia time, at a height of about 28,000 feet, the combination of pressure and heat caused the asteroid fragment to annihilate itself, producing a fireball and releasing energy equivalent to about 185 Hiroshima bombs. So again, with The Guardian reporting on the meteor that exploded over the Kamchatka Peninsula, 173 kilotons, and roughly 10 times the blast that destroyed Hiroshima. You know, Tunguska was about 185 times that blast. So we're talking about objects that are not easily detectable, but which are nonetheless capable of causing very widespread damage. And as I noted, new studies show, according to the latest models, that they may not be as easily destroyed either when they are on their way to Earth, even if we can spot them. So yeah, I think that, like George said when we had dinner last year, there's definitely some merit to some of the catastrophist way of seeing things, and I think it's important, especially as it relates to space objects that might collide with Earth, that we take those kinds of subjects very seriously. You know, something else that's been on my radar the last few days, and this involves a study that was carried out recently by Jari Luhelainen and David Miller, a pair of researchers in England who believe that they have carried out one of the most complete forensic investigations of a shawl linked to Jack the Ripper. And they also contend that they have now identified who they think the killer was. But this is kind of an addenda to a story that we covered earlier, because back in 2014, there was a book that came out entitled Naming Jack the Ripper by Russell Edwards. He's actually the owner of this shawl. And the premise behind the book was that he had hired the two, or at least one of the two forensic investigators aforementioned, and they had conducted studies of this shawl. But there was a problem in what they called the nomenclature, right? Because as Jari suggested at that time, there was a mutation that he expressed as 314.1C. He had said this was very rare and that this was something in terms of evidence that he could link directly to this shawl. The problem was it wasn't 314.1C, it was 315.1C, off by one digit. And of course, the mutation he was discussing was something that's actually very prevalent. And so a lot of people, especially in the forensic science community, were kind of poking fun at this and taking jabs, saying that this rare mutation is only found in maybe 90% of the entire Earth's population, something along those lines. And so they further argued that this discredited the study. But I guess we could say that the boys are back in town, and Jari and his cohort in this latest analysis studied mitochondrial DNA profiles that were recovered that matched both the victim, this believed to have been Catherine Eddowes, one of the victims of Jack the Ripper, and this suspect, whom we will discuss here more in just a moment. The researchers believe this helped them conclude that the shawl was indeed recovered from the crime scene and that that matched the most reliable witness testimony given about that scene. They said genomic DNA from single cells recovered from the evidence was amplified, noting that the physical and biochemical characteristics they analyzed, and this basically constituting what's called phenotypic information, which they used to refer to it in the study, this was a positive match for the only existing credible witness statement given. And they conclude basically that this is what happened. They believe Aaron Kosminski, a 23-year-old Polish barber living on Greenfield Street at the time of the killings, was the notorious killer who escaped capture. Now, this happens to be exactly the same person that they believed that they had identified when they named Jack the Ripper in the book Naming Jack the Ripper back in 2014. Does that present a problem? We have to look at it from this perspective. The evidence indeed may point to Kosminski as being Jack the Ripper. However, because that was the premise of their original study, there was a book written about this, and that came under fire due to that error in nomenclature. One could argue, and I'm not saying that they're wrong, by the way, but I am saying that one could argue that the interpretation of the data may have been biased somewhat in favor of the conclusion they'd already made and now felt that they had to be able to defend. And so the only reason I would reserve judgment on this one is because while they have definitely offered some tantalizing new evidence that strongly favors the conclusion that Aaron Kosminski, the barber butcher we might call him, that he indeed had probably been Jack the Ripper, we absolutely have to keep in mind that they were looking to try and prove that. It may not have been the first time around, but that was the conclusion they came to. They went to print with it, and then they were put in that unsavory situation where they had to try and defend that position. And so that definitely does raise some questions. And therefore, I think the only way that this will ever be conclusively proven, and that we can conclude that Kosminski, who lived, again, only like two blocks away from where one of the murders was carried out, so he was right there in the area. We do have some forensic evidence that links him to the crime. And this, of course, is something that has been proposed many times in the past, including by the forensic scientists and the author in question here. But I think there will have to be independent analysis that will further confirm those results through multiple testings that seem to corroborate those findings. I think that's the only way we can remove the possibility that there might be bias involved in a study like this. Nonetheless, it might be science bringing us one step closer to finding evidence of who exactly Jack the Ripper might have been. You know, something the Seven Ages guys and I were talking about over the weekend involves a discovery that was found on a remote island, and actually at the Columbia University blogs, Kevin Krajic was writing about this, and he notes that Cornelia Glass, a geochemist at Columbia University's Lamont Daugherty Earth Observatory, had come to a remote island to try and figure out a weird geological puzzle that turns up there. And this is what it was. They said some 4 million years ago, volcanic eruptions on the seabed piled lava upward almost 2 miles until it broke above the waves. And of course, then it kept piling up to form what is now the craggy, densely vegetated island of Anhuan. And since they're describing a pretty typical geological process that leads to the formation of islands, I mean, the fact that volcanic rock would be found on this island would not be surprising. What is surprising is the fact that they continued to find something that should not have been there. They also found what appears to be a massive pure white quartzite, and they say the apparent remains of a river or beach deposit formed on some faraway long-ago continent that is not supposed to be on that island. Now, one thing that initially came to mind was the idea that this might have been, rather than a deposit, that they had found simply an accumulation. If they had just found some quartz pebbles, that would be really interesting because that might suggest that someone long ago had actually carried the rock there, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Again, they say that this appears to be a formation, the remains of a river or a beach deposit, but this would have been formed a long time ago. I mean, a long, long, long time ago. And that absolutely is not something that should turn up on an island like this. The Columbia University blog post here reports that Anhuan stands alone, the only island in the world formed by volcanism that also contains an intact chunk of continent. They say this is contrary to plate tectonics. Quartzite bodies do not belong on volcanic islands. Now, it's not often that you find a geological study with implications like this, and I'm sure that on a future episode of the Seven Ages Audio Journal, we will be digging into this. In fact, I think we hope to devote an entire episode to geological anomalies in general, and we will get our team geologist James Waldo, who came on this program and did a geology show as well a while back, we'll have him comment on this because this is one of those odd outliers that really makes you think about things. And again, according to the terminology used by the folks there at Columbia University writing for their blog, this seems to be in contrast to plate tectonics. That doesn't mean that it completely uproots the theory. That's not what they're saying, merely that this is an anomaly, and hence it warrants mention here. But it is indeed a very weird one. I don't know what to make of it. And these kinds of earth mysteries or natural mysteries are always fascinating to me. There was another one that was reported the other day that involved a massive circular hole in the sky. What it actually was, not a hole in the sky so much as a hole in the clouds. The Daily Mail reported on this odd formation. They said United Arab Emirates citizens were left baffled after a mysterious whirlpool hole suddenly appeared in the sky above the city of Al Ain this weekend. The large circular patch of clear sky emerged inside the otherwise heavy cloud near the border with Oman as if somebody had punched a hole in the atmosphere. Now, an astronomer and meteorologist commented on this, Ihabrim Al-Yarwan, and he actually posted a clip about this on Twitter, calling it a rare and beautiful sight. A fall streak hole is what he referred to it as, or a hole punch cloud. And I'm always fascinated with the way that these formations in nature can tend to take on almost perfectly circular features. You see similar formations on the surfaces of lakes from time to time, both holes in the ice and sometimes just large circular disks on the surface. But again, it's fascinating to me the way that there seems to be this geometric element in nature from time to time, and that under the right circumstances, these kinds of unique geometric features appear and definitely have a very breathtaking effect. I love the natural stuff. And again, you know, going all the way back to Charles Fort, who was a little more in the camp that there were unnatural explanations for these kind of things, over time, as more and more natural explanations are forthcoming, I am all the more interested in the phenomena and the fact that, again, geometric features and what appears to be this, for lack of a better term, sort of harmonious element seems to arise from within nature. That, to me, is truly fascinating. You know, we talk an awful lot about science on this program, and among the issues that we face together as team civilization these days are issues pertaining to new technologies, our food supply, Earth's climate, and all kinds of other natural issues. But another one you may be familiar with, especially if you live in large urban areas, has to do with air quality. And I want to take a minute now to tell you about Molecule, because it's a complete reinvention of the air purifier, not just an improvement on existing but outdated technology. Now, this was developed by a scientist whose son suffered from asthma and who was frustrated by the fact that the HEPA air purifiers didn't relieve his son's symptoms. And so as a result, Dr. Yogi Goswami spent 20 years developing a completely new and totally effective way of removing indoor air pollutants. And I want to tell you a little bit about Dr. Goswami as well, because he's a distinguished professor and the director of the Clean Energy Research Center at the University of South Florida, who developed PECO, and that is exactly the technology behind Molecule. PECO actually destroys harmful pollutants like bacteria, viruses, mold, allergens, and airborne chemicals, instead of just collecting some of them on a filter. Molecule makes this revolutionary technology available to consumers so that others can experience the life-changing effects of clean air. Now, Molecule introduces a breakthrough science that is finally capable of destroying air pollutants at a molecular level, and hence the name. Molecule's PECO technology goes far beyond HEPA filtration to not just capture, but again, completely destroy the full spectrum of indoor air pollutants. And that includes those that are so small that HEPA technology cannot even capture. And with spring finally here, I know a lot of you guys out there are allergy sufferers. Well, Molecule makes a meaningful impact for asthma and allergy sufferers. In a study of 49 allergy sufferers presented at the American College of Asthma, Allergy, and Immunology, Molecule's technology provided dramatic, statistically significant, sustained symptom reduction within a week of use. That fast. The results have transformed lifelong allergy and asthma sufferers' lives, and one customer has even said that she was, quote, able to breathe through her nose for the first time in nearly 15 years. And I bet some of you at home probably have felt that way before. And so maybe it's time for you to start breathing the way that you wish you could and know that you should. Molecule can help ensure that breathing clean air is easy and also seamless. Now, Molecule's technology has been personally effective and verified by science, but most importantly, it's been tested by real people. Molecule has already helped allergy and asthma sufferers around the country better cope with their conditions and significantly reduce their symptoms. And that, my friends, is why you need to listen up, because for $75 off your first order, visit molecule.com, molecule.com, molecule with a K, and at checkout, enter TGR. That's the offer code. TGR is in the Graylian Report. Again, for $75 off your first order, visit molecule.com, and at checkout, enter TGR. You certainly won't regret it. And in the spring allergy season, now is the time to be preparing. In fact, I'm preparing to tell you about a new defense study that's hoping to put lasers in space, but also something very unusual that was seen in the skies out over Nevada. That's right, our friend Tyler Rogaway over at The Drive is at it again. What was seen? Well, not seen on radar. Over Nevada, we'll talk about that when we return here on The Graylian Report.
Do you enjoy true stories of the supernatural from the people who experienced it? Well, then you might like my show, Jim Harold's Campfire. Hi, I'm Jim, and we've been doing the show since 2009. And we talk about ghosts, cryptid creatures, UFOs, head scratchers, you name it. And you tune in and you might hear a story like this one.
And as he was driving home, he encountered a shadow person who seemed to be dressed like a monk. I know that sounds very strange, but it was a solid black form, and it was wearing a hooded cloak tied at the waist with the cloak up, and it had glowing red eyes. He sees this thing coming out of a really teeny abandoned cemetery.
If you haven't tuned in, I hope you'll check us out. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever podcasts are heard. It's Jim Harold's Campfire, and you can find it at jimharold.com. Thanks so much, and stay spooky.
We'll be right back.
keeping you company as we do every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Glad to be with you guys, as always. Still kind of getting caught up as I return from a week of archaeological adventures in the Southeast, and special thanks to everybody out there. Always great to see the fine folks in Southeastern archaeology and their wonderful patience, having people like me standing around asking questions, taking photographs. No, we actually try to provide a lot of photography for them and to try and aid in the efforts in terms of what they do, and it's certainly great work. More on that a bit later. In advance of this discussion about the weird things seen out there over in Nevada, I do want to touch on something else that may be seen soon in the skies in the near future. Now, Defense One reported on this the other day. They said that defense officials have asked for $304 million to fund research into space-based lasers, particle beams, and other new forms of missile defense next year. They say defense officials want to test a neutral particle beam in orbit, but that this won't occur until fiscal year 2023 as part of a ramped-up effort to explore various types of space-based weaponry. So what exactly are they trying to do here? Now, according to Patrick Tucker, who's a technology editor for Defense One, he says that the Pentagon is undertaking two different studies. The first is a $15 million exploration of whether satellites outfitted with lasers might be able to disable enemy missiles coming off the launch pad. Defense officials have said previously that these lasers would need to be in the megawatt class. They expect to finish the study, they say, within 6 months. Now, that's one thing they're trying to achieve. Apparently, they're also pouring money into a study of space-based neutral particle beams. And particle beams, of course, different from lasers, but nonetheless involving directed beam technology. But these, as opposed to the way lasers work, involve photons which travel at light speed. I'm going to have to get Jeff Hecht back on the program. You remember the guy who came on and talked about lasers and knows so much about this. He's been in the field for more than 30 years. Jeff would be just the guy to comment on this. Apparently, on Wednesday, officials speaking to reporters at the Pentagon voiced guarded confidence that they would result in something that would be, in fact, deployable. But they say this isn't the first time that the department has looked at such weapons. In 1989, the U.S. launched a neutral particle beam into space as part of an experiment called BEAR, or Beam Accelerator, aboard a rocket. I think the only thing that might be more interesting would be an actual BEAR aboard a rocket. That would indeed be very novel, but I already mentioned we were going to cover something that was seen recently in the skies out over Nevada. And again, Tyler Rogaway, he has kind of made a unique niche for himself, writing for The Drive, because he covers extremely credible instances where weird things happen in the skies. Not all of these necessarily point to unusual technologies. Sometimes they just appear to be unusual things happening in the sky, and one of the first stories he reported that really caught my attention had to do with an aircraft that was, again, according to those who observed it, traveling at a clip. It was moving fast, and this was seen flying over Oregon. And, again, it seemed to be, as those who saw it described it, just a light-colored aircraft. Nothing about it seemed to indicate that it wasn't a conventional plane of some kind, albeit one moving very quickly, which didn't have a transponder, and which was being tracked, essentially, by ATC operators who couldn't apparently track it very easily themselves. They were relying on visual cues from pilots in the sky who were able to observe the craft, and they were kind of triangulating its position. And Tyler further reported on details forthcoming from different agencies. I don't know that the FAA responded, but if memory serves, NORAD did release some information. And there were some audio recordings of flight controllers trying to go back and forth about what they thought it was when they filed the report thereafter. And it was certainly a weird report. Now, again, to me, it was by definition a UFO, but I couldn't tell you what in the world that aircraft was or what it was doing. It sounded an awful lot like it was somebody trying to remain, quite literally, off the radar. And so it could have been smugglers, people carrying drugs, people doing any number of different things that one would try to do when they're trying not to be seen doing it. But if you're in an aircraft flying in broad daylight, it's going to be awful hard not to be seen, especially if you are flying without your transponder. And if you'd like some additional details about transponder readings and the like, you might check out the video I put up on my YouTube channel recently about the MH370 flight, because I go into a lot of detail about the technical aspects of the disappearance of that flight, and it tells you about how a pilot can turn off the transponder and how a lot of the other systems relate to a plane that might go missing like that. Again, this plane didn't go missing. The one that Tyler Rogaway initially reported on, it was just one that was apparently trying not to be seen, and that was a weird incident. And interestingly, I think even Tucker Carlson on Fox News treated this very much like a quote-unquote UFO report. Again, to me, it sounded like a plane. But it wouldn't be the last report of this kind that Tyler Rogaway over at The Drive would report on. And I've actually reached out to him. I haven't heard back yet, but I would like to try and get him on the program. I know he's spoken with my colleague Alejandro a few times in the past. Might be something we could try and do. Here is what he has recently reported at The Drive after several similar articles like this that report on unusual aviation instances. This one popped up today, and it may be one of the most interesting to date. At around 9 p.m. local time, Tyler writes, on Saturday, March 16th, 2019, so this literally just a few days ago, an air ambulance helicopter was flying 15 miles west of central Las Vegas when something odd caught his aided eye. Okay, during an exchange with an air traffic controller, the pilot of Mercy Air 21, this an Augusta 119 Koala helicopter, noted spotting an unidentified object some distance from his position, and only he was likely able to see it in the darkness as he was wearing night vision goggles. Now, the controller responded that he had nothing on radar in the area where he was seeing the object, but when he heard the pilot could only see it through his night vision goggles, he responded with amazement. Now, apparently, Aircraft Spots on Twitter is the one that brought this to the attention of Tyler Rogaway. They mentioned this exchange, and then they obtained the audio, and that was later posted on SoundCloud. I would like to play a little of that audio now to give you an idea of the interaction between the ATC operator and the man who was piloting the helicopter who saw this object, but only through his night vision.
Mercy Air 21, radar contact, 15 to the west of Las Vegas. VOR, straight through Bravo Airspace.
Hey, 21, position checks. And just to advise, it looks like I have some sort of object over the Southern Hills area. Looks to be about 7,000 feet. Could be a balloon or something along those lines. It's unlit, so just advise.
Okay, I'm not seeing anything in that area, but that's not to say, like you're saying, there's something out there.
Yeah, I can only see it. I got night vision goggles on. I can only see it through the goggles.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's awesome indeed. I love those kinds of recordings. Now, again, some of this may have to do with radar horizon, that critical area of performance for aircraft detection systems defined by the distance at which the radar beam rises enough above the Earth's surface to make detection of a target at low level impossible, and hence that expression, flying below the radar. The pilot mentioned that he estimated this was at 7,000 feet, but I believe that the report goes on to say that they actually can't clock this thing on radar. Now, the controller definitely did say that he couldn't see it either. The problem is that it should have been something that appeared on radar at that time, at that altitude, in relation to where the ATC operators were. And presumably they also had that helicopter that the pilot communicating with ATC was flying. That should have been seen on radar too. So Tyler at The Drive writes that we ran back the tracking data, Flight Radar 24, and that's a very useful app for stuff like this. I have it on my smartphone. And they said that during the time of the radio exchange, they couldn't find anything unusual in the area where the pilot saw the object. They said that they couldn't find Mercy Air 21 definitively either. So the helicopter did not definitively appear on Flight Radar 24 at that time. That's kind of interesting. They said that isn't surprising, however, because, again, lower flying aircraft have spotty tracking in that area. Precisely what we're talking about. They said, we did find an air ambulance helicopter that briefly appeared over the western Las Vegas metropolitan area at about the right time of the radio call. Now, although this aircraft does appear, apparently Aircraft Spots, the Twitter handle we mentioned earlier, notes that the aircraft, N608CF, doesn't historically use the Mercy Air 21 call sign. And Tyler writes, still, it is the same type of aircraft as the one that does and appears to be owned by the same company, Air Methods, so it is possible that this was the helicopter communicating with air traffic control, although its position is closer to the center of Las Vegas than it should be, at least based on the positioning call given by the air traffic controller in the recorded audio. I don't know. It seems a little spotty to me. I would first want to look and see if there were any other helicopters in the area. Perhaps they did that. But Tyler argues that really all that doesn't matter much. He said, what we're left with here is an interesting piece of air traffic control audio, more than an unexplained sighting of a pressing or extremely extraordinary nature. As the pilot noted, it could simply have been a balloon, but it does seem a bit odd spotting an unlit balloon at night with night vision goggles from miles away. The altitude is also interesting. They said 7,000 feet isn't exactly low, but without more information and or additional witnesses, we don't have much to warrant further investigation. Now, those were the details with Tyler's original report, but there have been updates made since this was reported on Saturday. He said there was a bit of confusion about the time indexing, and apparently because they were UTC signed, Tyler had been looking at information that was actually one day behind for the right time. They said it would have been the 17th,
not the 16th of March. And hence this is officially a St. Patrick's Day UFO we're talking about. Tyler says, when we reviewed the correct data from Flight Radar 24, we got Mercy Air 21 exactly where it should have been and roughly 15 miles west of KLAS. So in fact, the aircraft in question was found at exactly the location it should have been on the correct night. He says, we can also positively ID the helicopter. It was an Augusta A109 registered N238AM, belonging again to Air Methods. We also now have better positioning information, and according to this, MA-21 would have been roughly 9 miles from the South Hills Hospital, the approximate area where the pilot thought the object was flying at about 7,000 feet when the radio exchange occurred. Now, this is a fairly interesting anecdote right here, and this is Tyler's opinion, but he says, a 9-mile visual ID of a party balloon or something like that at night using NVGs, basically night vision goggles, seems really questionable. He said, so the size of the object and its exact configuration is the big question at this point. We also know that the A-109 was flying at 7,000 feet, so the pilot would have seen this object at eye level from his perspective. Now, first question that comes to mind for me, has anyone tried to locate the pilot with the company in question? However, in the final update provided on March 18th, we may get a little additional information about why we don't have specific information directly from the pilot. This is what Tyler wrote. He says, we finally talked to the Mercy Air Operations Base where the helicopter flies out of, and they informed us that Air Methods headquarters had told them not to provide comment or access to the pilot who was talking on the radio and spotted the object. They told us Air Methods wants any inquiries sent to their headquarters. Now, the problem is that I reached out to them and have heard nothing back in well over 24 hours. I will keep trying to contact them directly, but at this point it looks as if they are actively trying to avoid discussing the event with us. So is it a cover-up? A conspiracy? What do they know that they aren't talking about? Well, it could very well be that they know from previous articles Tyler has published at The Drive that these kinds of stories tend to get a lot of attention. And maybe that company simply doesn't want a bunch of attention. Again, Tyler Rogoway has appeared on Fox News talking about this with Tucker Carlson and a number of other outlets. And of course, we're talking about it right here. And when these kinds of potentially high-profile incidents occur, often these companies simply don't want that kind of attention. And so maybe that is at least one interpretation of why they may not be talking about it. And therefore, like the object that was observed, for the time being, the pilot, I suppose, will also have to remain off the radar. Interesting case, nonetheless. Good work, Tyler Rogoway. We always look forward to your work out there. When we return, I've got one more quick update before we get into our discussion with George Howard. I want to catch up with him about some of the latest information forthcoming about the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. More on that in a bit. I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. You know, another story we've been following for a while, and there is a pretty significant update about. I'm excited about this. We have talked in recent weeks about the Eastern Cougar, and at least since last year, it has been officially extinct. But some are challenging that. More on that in a moment. I want to first mention that while Jason Pentrail and I were in South Carolina, we were working with some archaeologists. I won't name them here due to one of the interesting stories they told. But one of the folks we were working with had said he was on a dig site in Mississippi. I think I can say that much. And he observed what he believed to have been a black panther, he said. A large black cat. Now, some of the other folks on the team had kind of chuckled about it, but I think in our discussion with one of the PhDs there on the site, wonderful guy, and Jason and I were just having a ball picking his brain, At some point, some biological anomalies and things came up, and he kind of chuckled and said, you should ask that fellow over there about what he saw. And the fellow said, very matter-of-factly, they gave me a hard time, said it was just a big house cat, but he said, I'm sure it wasn't. He said, I saw it at a distance crossing a road early in the morning. This was obviously a very large black cat. And he said that the tail was much longer. And again, that was the most probably identifying characteristic. He said that when you see a house cat running by and the tail might shoot up in the air, you know, you know when you're looking at a house cat, basically. He said this long, slinky tail behind this animal and the way it moved and stalked low to the ground, he said, I mean, this was a black panther. Now, stories like that always interest me. But then another fellow who was an avocationalist volunteering there on the site, he was part of a team that comes out every year and helps on the site. He said, you know, we've got one here too. And I said, you're kidding. And he said, yeah, right down the road here. He said, if you guys walk down that road, a road, in fact, that Pentrail and I had been walking probably earlier that afternoon because we walked an entire huge tract of land on this particular area that we were working, trying to get a feel for the land and taking photographs and everything. And he said, yeah, right down that road where you guys had been, we saw a number of years ago a large black cat. And he said, there's no mistaking, this is no house cat. And especially when it comes to other kinds of animals that might be mistaken for being a large black cat. I mean, we do have bobcats and we do have lynxes from time to time. In the Southwest, you also have the ocelots. But these animals are not large and black. The black coloration is one of the weirdest things about these sightings when they occur. And so, now the Eastern Cougar, of course, is by no means a dark-colored cat. But nonetheless, there appear to continue to be reports of these things. And when we were talking about this recently on the program, there was an attack on a woman that occurred in eastern North Carolina, and they were trying to determine what it might have been. And again, the DNA analysis clearly showed it, you know, was some kind of a dog. They said it was canine. Might have been a wild dog, could have been a coyote, probably not. Coyotes usually don't attack people, but again, a good friend of ours, actually, it's Bruce Smith, who was the drummer in my dad's band, The Satyrs, back in the 1960s that we hear about from time to time. Yeah, Bruce had actually said that recently there were some scraps that were out on his front porch, and he'd gone for a walk early one morning and was coming back in, and there was a coyote there in the yard that was picking over those scraps, and he tried to shoo it away, and it just growled at him. Yeah, in other words, actually, while it's exhibiting wild characteristics there, the fact that it didn't run when it saw him and instead just growled is actually more a sign of the coyotes becoming tame than anything. Again, they're acclimating to the presence of humans, and instead of running at the sight of a person, it just growled and said, no, I'm going to keep eating my breakfast. You keep away. Yeah, probably not a good sign either. But the coyotes are essentially one of the leading scavengers in America now. And in fact, my own parents had said that there had been one in broad daylight yesterday right out behind their house. So you do see those pretty commonly. And that's another idea. Well, maybe you guys have just been seeing coyotes. Surely it wasn't actually a cougar. Well, writing for the Charlotte Observer, Mark Price, who's written for them for years, he always writes really interesting stuff. And I'd actually like to reach out to Mark at some point, maybe see if he'd come on the show. Because I try not to get too regional with the subjects I address on the Graylian Report. Again, we have a global listening audience. But what Mark wrote about the other day really is interesting, and yes, it is close to home. He says, cougars are extinct in North Carolina, but a few dozen people came forward on Facebook over the weekend to say that they're still seeing them here in North Carolina, no matter what the experts say. Now, apparently starting on Saturday, when a chef in Morganton sheepishly admitted on a Facebook page devoted to Bigfoot research that he believes he saw a cougar, also known as a mountain lion, near the incorporated community of Nebo in western North Carolina. I mean, that's right down the road from me, probably no less than 45 minutes from where I'm seated. And this fellow, Billy Hensley, is his name. He said, I know I'll catch some flack for this, but I will swear to this to my grave. I've seen a cougar not once, but twice in Nebo in the past month or so. Now, instead of being mocked, Hensley's post was met, Mark reports, with comment after comment from people who say that they, too, have seen what they believed to be a cougar in the region. Some folks also got a little defensive, saying that they were afraid that they would be accused of misidentifying a bobcat or a cougar. Here's what John Bruner wrote. He said, Billy, we jumped one at Lake James one night on an expedition. Presumably a Bigfoot expedition. I don't know. I mean, you hear some interesting stories from time to time, right? He says, it was huge and had a tail 3 feet long. It was not a bobcat. Now, again, that feature, like one of the archaeologists told me recently, that long tail, He said this was very different from a house cat. This was a very large animal. And he said further, it's not a bobcat that we saw. I've seen one about half a mile from my house in Green Mountain, which is in Yancey County, and this according to Kim Owens Mayhew. She said, definitely a cougar. And apparently, she said, I've seen bobcats too, and they're not even close to the same size, length, and of course, yes, the tails are different. This is one of those characteristics you will continually see people who have observed these animals reporting on. Another view came from Tiffany Al-Maktari, who wrote, I think it's condescending and dismissive when wildlife biologists or whoever say that they aren't around when people obviously are seeing them. There was one outside of my son's school, she says, once all the kids saw it, and they are just incredibly elusive. Now, Mark Price also notes here that NC Wildlife Resources officials told the Charlotte Observer that eastern cougars are an extinct species of large cat that is now only found in part of Florida. At full-size, males are an unmissable 6 to 8 feet long and can weigh 150 pounds. You know what I propose? Yes, I think it's time for us to get back into the field, and this time I don't have to travel to another state. I just ride a little ways down the mountain. But maybe it's time for an official Graylian Report investigation into whether there are still eastern cougars existent somewhere here nearby, because people continue to say that they see them, and I wouldn't be surprised. Some critically endangered animals can indeed be very elusive, especially if we're talking about big cats. I wouldn't be surprised in the least if there aren't still a few roaming around out there in the wilderness, and perhaps right in my backyard too. All right, we'll be talking a little more about the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis when we come back here on the Graylian Report.
Science, space, and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the bunker where the coffee is always dark and delicious. I'm Micah Hanks. And as we launch into the second hour of this week's edition of the program, I am eager to get back on the mic with my friend, George Howard, good friend of the program, get his views on things. You know, he is sort of, I guess, what you'd call an avocationalist like me, and he operates the Cosmic Tusk website. He is not a professional archaeologist or geologist, but he is multidisciplinary in his approach and loves all this stuff. More on that in just a few minutes when we get into that discussion with him. First, I want to remind you, if you aren't already a subscriber and you would like to show some support for the Graylian Report, one way you can do that is to sign up today at graylianreport.com/X. That gets you access to weekly additional podcasts, monthly specials like Graylian Enigmas, and of course the entire back catalog, all on a single RSS feed so you never miss a show. It's certainly the best way that you can support our ongoing endeavors and efforts here at the Graylian Report. And if you are like me, you enjoy talking into a microphone and sharing knowledge with people, interacting and doing interviews and discussions, roundtables, things like that, or if you don't already and you'd like to, you might check out my book, The Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting. It is an all-in-one book that will tell you everything you need to know about how to do a podcast of your own, or like I said, if you're someone who does podcasts and you enjoy it like me, but you want a new approach or some new ideas, this book would be for you too. Now, my good friend Maria contacted me the other day. I've known her for years, and she said, you know, a friend of mine and I, we've decided we want to do a podcast. We want to know what to buy, how much we have to spend, what we do need, what we don't need, and the best way that we could do this. And so I offered some advice for them about here are the best ways you can do this. This is the easiest method, and I, of course, will always tell people, like I say in my book, if you're trying podcasting for the first time, unless you are just, you know, hell-bent for leather and know that this is going to be something you are going to do, if you have never done it before and you want to see if you like it first, don't buy a ton of equipment. Buy the bare essentials. Try it out. If you enjoy it and it seems like something you want to get better at, do more often, and do a little bit more professionally, then that is when you want to start buying your equipment. Don't buy it all from the outset. And podcasting can definitely be done very inexpensively. Again, I think one of the best tools available to us these days is YouTube. A lot of people, instead of buying a bunch of podcasting gear, they have a simple USB microphone and they start a YouTube channel. You know, point in case, my friend Chris Cottrell, who joined the Seven Ages research team on the road this past week, wonderful fella from a little south of Savannah. James had met him before. Jason and I, we'd spoken with Chris, but he actually joined us and was our roommate for the weekend and helped us in the field, provided transportation and a very large truck, which was really fit for doing some field work. And so, Chris, thank you for all your help out there on the road. But, you know, Chris has a wonderful YouTube channel called The Dabbler's Den. And as the name entails, he's into a little of everything, but he likes to focus on a lot of the same sort of thing that here in a few minutes I'm going to be talking with George Howard about. I do first want to get to just a few listener emails because I wasn't able to in recent weeks. And the first one comes from Lucretia over in Ireland, who writes, "Hello, Micah. I just wanted to drop a line after listening to this week's Graylian Report. I enjoy the podcast every week from my home here in the west of Ireland. And this week you were definitely speaking my language. An area of my post-grad work is in the use of technology and robotics in social care, particularly in the care of elderly people and the ethical quagmire resulting from such. I think we need to move past the idea of technology in medical care and social care being either good or bad, but rather how we can manage the use of it appropriately, as I fear the technology will keep permeating every aspect of life regardless. I've attached two short pieces from my post-grad work that will help give you an idea of some of the main authors in the game if you feel like having a look. I'm afraid I take a Eurocentric view, however, due to my locale. Robots in care settings are no longer science fiction. What a time to be alive. I hope you enjoy your excursions this week in the pursuit of some archaeology. We have some pretty good relics in Ireland if you get the chance to visit soon. Love the show and appreciate all the hard work that you, Lauren, and the rest of the Graylian team put into the show. Take care, Lucretia." That's a wonderful name, by the way. I've always liked that name. And I do hope to get to Ireland one day. Haven't been there yet, but our good friend Jan Fitzgerald, of course, one of our regular newsies, she lives there, and she's always saying, "Let me know when you get over here, because I've got a jam that I'm going to take you to. One of my favorite pubs, and we all get out the guitars and have a good time." Definitely something I'll want to do when I get over there. And I've been telling Jan I'd do that for years, so Lucretia, I'll put you on the list too. I hope to see a lot of you guys next time I get over to the Isles. You know, the Seven Ages team, we've talked some about trying to make a trip over that way at some point, so maybe we can make that happen. We also got a message from my good man Charles, who often writes in, and he said, "Good morning, Micah. Self-driving cars with humans at the wheel are all over Scottsdale, Arizona. And as you can see from both these emails, apparently the AI discussion last week really hit home with people." He says they probably will work rather well here because inclement weather is rare. But what about other areas of the country? If and when a self-driving car can negotiate the hills of Duluth, Minnesota during a snowstorm, I might, and stress the might, have fewer reservations about them. That's a really good point, Charles. Until then, he says, "You may place me in the ranks of the modern-day Luddites, whose motto might well be, just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should. P.S. If you haven't already seen coverage of this, there seems to be evidence that impacts of extraterrestrial bodies happened in South America at the Younger Dryas boundary. Here's the link to the UPI article he includes, and of course, what he's referring to there happens to be a paper that was published in Scientific Reports, some of the co-authors of which we were actually with over the weekend while we were in the field. And this is indeed exciting information. And to give you kind of a brief overview of what precisely we're talking about, this new study has found, and in fact, this is a large-scale study referred to by the authors as, quote, the most extensive investigation south of the equator, apparently offers evidence in South America of the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. Now, I wrote at sevenages.org just today that in a paper published in Scientific Reports, the team led by Mario Pino with the Transdisciplinary Center for Quaternary Research at the Universidad Austral de Chile in Valdivia, Chile, discovered evidence of several elements associated with the controversial theory previously found in North America. Now, the focus of the current study, of course, was a site called Pilauco Bajo, a late Pleistocene archaeological site at Osorno in southern Chile. And in fact, quick shout out to Felipe Rios, one of our listeners, who wrote to me recently, not only said he got the podcasting book and wants to weigh in on that side of things, but Felipe is right down there in the area where this study was done, and he's always keeping me up to date on things. So Felipe, thank you for writing about this. I really appreciate always hearing from you. We hope to get down to Chile and visit you guys and your late Pleistocene archaeological sites too. But Pino's past studies, that being again the lead author of this new paper, produced radiocarbon dates for human and megafaunal occupation dating back to about 14,000 to 14,700 before present. That, of course, being well in advance of Clovis. And there are a lot of sites. Again, the most famous in that region, probably Monteverde, whereas James Adovasio and others have noted, there are some radiocarbon dates earlier than 30,000 years. But I don't think that there's been enough of a paradigm shift in modern archaeology to be accepting of those kind of dates for the Americas yet. Now, kind of like the idea of Eastern cougars still stomping around the Southeast, nothing would surprise me. I would not be surprised in the least if evidence forthcoming does not show 30, 50, 80, or perhaps even more, and I'm talking thousands of years ago, people being in the Americas. That would not surprise me. But again, we're still working toward consensus on that information. So, needless to say, there's an awful lot going on down there in that part of the world. Now, a few years ago, when Pino and other Chilean scientists were studying the sediment layers there at Pilauco Bajo, they began to recognize what appear to be features associated with the Younger Dryas impact event. And this, again, as described already at several North American sites. But among the key discoveries had been this so-called black mat layer, dating to approximately 12,800 BP, which coincided with the disappearance of human artifacts and evidence of megafaunal remains. And at this site, they also found this unusual platinum anomaly, as referenced by our colleague Christopher Moore in his paper from 2017, which appeared, I believe, in the same journal, and is noted by another gentleman who is well-respected in the sciences, Dr. James Kennett. And he is, I believe, a professor emeritus at UC Santa Barbara. Kennett says that there are things that are specific to this site that make it particularly important. And what he actually said in an interview at The Current, which is a publication of the same university, UC Santa Barbara, they said that there is an abundance of spherules rich in chromium, an element that is not common at North American sites that are similar to this and from that same era. And so according to Kennett, and this is the quote from him in The Current, he said, "It turns out that volcanic rocks in the southern Andes can be rich in chromium, and these rocks provided a local source for the chromium, and thus the cometary objects must have hit South America as well." And so that's essentially their whole contention, that there is evidence now in South America that cometary fragments may have struck the Earth. There's local evidence for this, and then there are similarities to North American sites, which include that platinum anomaly and other rare earth elements, and yes, that black mat layer, coinciding with what appear to be drop-offs in megafaunal remains, and also perhaps impact to human occupation as well. And perhaps most notably, the paper refers to this biomass burning, widespread fire that occurred coinciding with all of this. And so with all this evidence, again, we have some of the world's leading scientists, and I really think it's fair to say that, in terms of geologists, archaeologists, etc., who are looking at this. And further evidence continues to mount that is pointing to the idea that there was an impact that occurred around 12,800 years ago. And so I love talking with people who share my fascination with this. And about to join us is my good friend George Howard, who is the man behind the website called Cosmic Tusk. And that name, especially for those who follow his work, will probably be recognized as a reference to a particular mammoth tusk, which contained similar evidence of these so-called microspherules referenced in the recent paper in Scientific Reports. And in fact, since this paper appeared online over the weekend while we were out there doing our archaeology thing, and we were with at least one of the co-authors of that paper at the time, I wanted to be able to quickly reference it and be able to find it online, and I knew the first place I would go to find it would be Cosmic Tusk, and sure enough, George had it linked front and center. Now, first of all, George, what do magnetic and glassy impact-related spherules, high-temperature minerals and melt glass, nanodiamonds, carbon spherules, acidiform carbon, platinum, osmium, iridium, and other elements, and that now includes an abundance of chromium at anomalous concentrations, all have in common? I'll give you a hint. We now have evidence for it on not one, two, or three, but four continents.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Micah. Exactly. And you're describing the exact same suite of evidence that the Comet Research Group has been identifying at well-dated archaeological sites. Typically, this was a paleontological site, I think, its main focus, but has been finding those same impact proxies at places all over the world and all over North America, and now it has been discovered in Chile and well-published in Nature Reports.
Yeah, and I've just got to give a shout-out that while I was out there in the field over the weekend with the Seven Ages guys, George, we were with one of the authors of this paper, and we went to your website to find it because I knew Cosmic Tusk would have that paper featured front and center, and there it was. And it's not the only one. You've got an actual archive of science literature pertaining to the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and you've had that up for a while now, right?
Appreciate you bringing it up. It was kind of the project for the first quarter that we managed to get done a little bit sooner than I thought. I had long wanted to have a place on the website where every single Younger Dryas impact hypothesis paper, pro, con, or in the middle, was available to the public, and you can actually see both a table format where you can read each of the names of the papers that link over to the paper, or you can actually see a nice slick visual accordion file of each paper, and each one's color-coded according to their position on the hypothesis. And as we know, the positive indications that there was a tremendous catastrophe is winning the day in that bibliography. There are far more papers in support than there are in opposition.
Now, that's important because, again, rather than just featuring those that are in support, you are looking at this cumulatively. You're looking at all of the papers which discuss this, which also includes those which are not in favor of the impact hypothesis. Is that correct?
I do, and anybody can look at those papers and make their own conclusions. And I would actually encourage people that aren't accustomed to reading science papers, if published papers, if they have an interest in this subject, go ahead and give it a try. You don't need to know everything in them to get the gist of it and see the level of work that was done. And I might go ahead and say that generally the level of detail of our papers is much more comprehensive than those that are critical.
Absolutely. I mean, I really appreciate that. And that reminds me of something. In fact, actually, Dr. James Kennett, who was one of the contributors to the recent study that appeared in Scientific Reports, he had sent us a paper a while back. And in that, they were talking about, I actually have it right here in front of me, they were talking about some of the conflicting opinions about some of the evidence that they had found. And they, and I want to read this. It said, the studies reporting negative results did not use rigorous dating methods or did not follow the requisite analytical protocol, for example, by not performing crucial analyses using scanning electron microscopy and electron diffraction spectroscopy. Boiling all that down, they're very specific about the processes that they are utilizing to make these determinations, and they simply ask for the same level of care and analytical protocol for those who are going to make similar analyses and then judge it thereafter. Again, what it seems to show, like you said, George, is that these crucial analyses are showing favorably that there's something that happened 12,800 years ago. Now, you've been on the beat with this for a long time, and that led you to form Cosmic Tusk. And so for those who aren't familiar with your work, let's go back in time for a minute. You started with Cosmic Tusk. Why? What got you into this?
Oh, frustration that that our side, I don't want to say our because I don't speak for the entire research group, but I speak as a member of it. And I was personally frustrated that a lot of the information wasn't available and was that there was actually some misdirection and misinformation out there, particularly about whether there had been confirmations of the findings, the original findings in 2007, and subsequent additional evidence, too, was initially refuted by some pretty sloppy papers. And then by, they were being taken quite seriously, and I wanted to point out some of their deficiencies as well as show the supporting confirmations of our evidence, which started rolling in shortly after I got the Tusk. So it was, I could have had a very failed website if our hypothesis had failed, but our hypothesis has been successful, and that's led the Tusk to have a lot of good content to put up for people to read.
Yeah. The name, by the way, the Cosmic Tusk, we got to talk about that just for a minute, too, because that is, especially for people who were early followers of Richard Firestone and William Topping's work, they'll be familiar with the idea of the actual Cosmic Tusk, right?
Yeah, you may have revealed really the reason I started the blog is because I thought of the name and I thought it was such a cool and appropriate name that I had to do a blog around it.
Yeah.
It was actually a part of it. Yeah, but yeah, the Cosmic Tusk is kind of referring to an earlier part of the theory where they believe some actual animal parts might have shown evidence of cosmic material or cosmic material itself embedded in some of the mammoth ivory. The dates ended up being much, much older than the event that we were principally interested in, so it was a bit of a wet red herring. But I don't think there's anything you could call that particular piece of megafauna remains other than a cosmic tusk, and what a cool moniker.
Absolutely. Absolutely indeed. And, you know, again, that has been something that has been consistent throughout these studies, the evidence for both a cosmic impact, but what's specifically fascinating about the latest paper appearing in Scientific Reports, and again, some of the co-authors were people that we know pretty well, James Kennett, Dr. Christopher Moore, a good friend of ours. They have pointed out some things that are very specific to that environment, which is important because it helps rule out external sources for the phenomena observed there particular to that region. I want to quote Dr. Kennett from an article that appeared in The Current, which is a publication of UC Santa Barbara, and he said, it turns out that volcanic rocks in the southern Andes can be rich in chromium. And he said these rocks provided a local source for this chromium, and thus the cometary objects must have hit South America as well. This is interesting because, again, we're finding more and more evidence in that localized fashion that says, hey, look, you know, this was much more widespread, and there's good evidence to support that. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means that we have truly a global catastrophe on our hands now, and the Comet Research Group, as its practice, kind of hedged its bets on that for many years and referred to it as a tremendous cataclysm in the Northern Hemisphere that had dramatic effects in the Northern Hemisphere. But now the evidence has led us to conclude and led the paper co-authors, I was not on the paper, to conclude that that there's dramatic evidence for climate change in South America as well. And as you point out, the metal chromium was found in some of the material, which is only found in those, at least in the region. So they suspect that there must have been an impact of some sort down there to supply the chromium. But regardless, the evidence that climate changed dramatically at that time, and we'll discuss the nature of that change, but it's very, very clear. The importance of the change, and kind of a curious thing that is going to be great to unwind in coming years based on further evidence, was that the climate in the Southern Hemisphere apparently changed in the opposite direction than that in the Northern Hemisphere. Anybody familiar with the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis probably has come to understand that the Younger Dryas was a 1,200-year period of absolute chilling cold that happened in the Northern Hemisphere and is well documented for 50 years, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere as a coming in and well accepted. The question is what caused that cold period. But what happened in South America was a dramatic sudden transition to a warmer climate, a warmer and drier climate, where in the Northern Hemisphere it became colder and more moist. So isn't that an interesting comparison there between the two, and there's probably a lot of paleoclimate science to be done to unwind why that occurred.
Well, absolutely. And again, it's not unlike other climate changes that we have seen throughout time, where when you have that, I believe the term for it is meridional effect out there in the ocean, you have the disruption basically of the Gulf Stream, and that causes circulation of ocean currents to become disrupted, and therefore you have that concentration of cooler ocean waters up there in the northern hemispheres. And then, for instance, right off the southeastern coast of the modern United States, we also had a warm pocket, also probably related to that effect. But again, in the southern hemispheres, it's not, again, uncommon, and it's certainly not implausible to see that kind of a warmer pocket form right there. What's interesting to me, and I remember talking to Dr. Kennett about this, is that he said this event is unlike other climate changes, even those coming out of past ice ages going back, hundreds of thousands of years. And he says the important thing to remember here is that, again, the Younger Dryas is anomalous for a variety of reasons, but we're finding an accumulation of evidence that does suggest that the causal agent here was this cosmic impact. Kind of like with the whole Hiawatha crater thing that came out earlier. And that's still kind of the talk of the town because it is a possible impact feature. The other idea, of course, being that some of these events may not have been impacts at all, but airbursts along the lines of Tunguska.
Yeah, there would have been a variety of different objects is what the hypothesis proposes now. Some that would have been small enough so that they would have exploded in the atmosphere, but with tremendous, tremendous effects, on the ground, both thermal and, concussion and shockwave. Then some would have made it all the way to the ground, and some were apparently quite large that made it to the ground, and that's what may have created, still not confirmed, of course, the Hiawatha crater, and now its twin. I believe they're proposing, it's not Patterson, I can't remember the name that is proposed, but it hasn't been affixed to it yet, but crater number two, which was found more than 100 kilometers inland in Greenland, and that was identified in a paper by that same Danish team, just a couple of months ago. So since the last time I've talked with you, they have found another crater, and it was also roughly 20 miles wide. And remember that feature would have been a 20-mile-wide hole of filled with molten rock as a result of the impact. So it's almost certain, or I believe it is certain, and well agreed that it happened in the Pleistocene. And, of course, we had Homo sapiens at that time. So people surely saw it. The question is, was it as recent as 12,000 years ago? And do those two impacts match up with the dating of the evidence that we're finding on those four continents that you've explained?
Yeah. Something that fascinates me about you, George, and I knew this from the minute you and I sat down together in Asheville at a bar and ordered a beer and started talking. You keep up to date on all this. You have followed this. And you are able, your retention and capability in terms of remembering names and locations and information and processing that data and being able to whip that out just off the cuff. You can do it as well as or better than I do. And man, I got to hand it to you. That is so important because you know, I've got a lot of friends in the sciences who a lot of them don't even like going on podcasts, and they certainly don't like being a science communicator who talks about these things. You do an exemplary job, and I just want to hand that to you.
Oh, well, thanks a lot. I think I've discussed with you before, I describe myself as the ball boy for the real researchers, right? And that it's a little bit like being the biggest fan of the team, and then they ask you to get on the bus, and you get to travel with them, and you just help out where you can. Well, the ball boy always knows the statistics probably even better than the players, right?
Good point.
But they're a sports fan. And actually, funny enough, I'm not a big sports fan, so I've probably taken that area where most of my buddies are remembering Carolina basketball statistics back to the 50s, and I've taken that area of my brain and focused on this weird part of science. So I think we all have our intense interests and the ability to retain a lot of information if you're absolutely, if you're a tremendous fanatic about the subject. And I am in this case, so it makes it easy to follow. And it's also, you know, it's gone over a long time. So these things don't come in. There have been several papers, you know, this year, but if you keep up with the four or five different published articles a year, it's pretty easy to keep up with the subject. But thank you. I appreciate your compliment there, Mike.
Well, absolutely, George. And again, you know, we're of like mind, and I appreciate the science that goes into this too. And, you know, I've for the longest time really tried to kind of hold out and say, look, I'm interested in the younger Dryas, whatever the causes behind it may be. Respected scientist that he is, you know, James Kennett was, I think, the one that the way he phrased it, oh, no, look, I'm telling you, there's nothing else quite like this. And I said, what about Dryas-like phenomena coming into and going out of past ice ages? He said, look, this one's different, and here's why. And, you know, and he'll lay it all out there for you. And again, we're talking about one of the most respected geological scientists probably that exists on planet Earth right now, wouldn't you say?
Exactly right. He just lost a great colleague, too, that was actually known as the grandfather of global warming and actually the first person to popularize that very popular term, Dr. Wally Broecker. And Wally Broecker was head of the big Lamont Doherty Earth Sciences Lab up at Columbia. And he was, you know, I don't even think arguably, but the most distinguished climate scientist in the world. And he and Kennett published together in their earliest and most significant papers concerning the Younger Dryas and concerning the Gulf Stream and how the Gulf Stream had come to a stop at this very time. And they had both puzzled over that for many, many years. And both Kennett and Broecker, towards the end of his life, you know, have discovered what the cause was, and Wally even admitted that. It hasn't been reported in the press, but I've got it on the Tusk, and I think it's a significant development that the greatest climate scientist of all time, towards the end of his life, agreed with his longtime collaborator and co-author, Kennett, that it was actually a cosmic impact that caused their enigmatic cold spell, the Younger Dryas.
Yeah. Well, it's that accumulation of evidence. And again, Wally Broecker and Kennett, I mean, some of the most regarded names in science today. Sometimes I think we have to kind of err to their judgment on these kinds of things. They are absolutely looking at the data and saying, look, this doesn't make us more popular among our colleagues necessarily. We're just trying to tell you the truth. And that reminds me of something that you told me when we were here in Asheville hanging out. You'd said at one point, you were like, Mike, I think one of the most respectable things you can do is, you know, advocate catastrophism. And I think a lot of people just consider it a sensational subject, but I want to demystify it here for a moment, because if indeed we're talking about a catastrophic impact, and we can understand, again, the nuances of that, what climate changes occur, what effect it has on populations of living species and also flora. I mean, all the different environmental effects of something like this. And more importantly, with innovations in space science, technology, astronomy, etc., if we can prevent future cataclysms along those lines, this is not only something that is meritorious, it's also really important for the survival of the human race, don't you think?
Well, I hate to speak in terms of future impacts, because I think a lot of people do that more effectively than I do, so I generally keep to the past.
Sure.
But the past is prologue, and that's what you're suggesting, is that the past is prologue. And if we can understand the past, we can have some understanding of what's to come, and unfortunately... but fortunately, we've discovered it. The past is filled with some with great catastrophes that have been not recognized and, in fact, kind of suppressed by the uniformitarian approach of most geologists now. Now, that door was opened up a great deal in 1980 when they first proposed and then later proved the dinosaur killing comet in the Yucatan.
Mm-hmm.
Traveling much that same path with this work, but it has much more significance for humans because it had anthropological consequences, as you suggest, ones that we haven't even begun to unravel.
Yeah, and we continue to see evidence of that, and that's one of the things that's been reported in the new paper, that again, we see what appears to be an effect on megafaunal species, but also human populations right around that time. There was another paper, by the way, that Jason Pintrail and I found. This other paper, which appeared in Science Advances, refers to a butchering site where they had found a megafaunal sloth remains that had been butchered, and this occurring around 12,600 years ago, so shortly after the period we're discussing with relation to the Dryas. And their contention was this shows evidence that these animals actually didn't live much longer, that they did in fact die out around this time. And the reason why, they said, was because of human predation. Humans were killing them. And I'm thinking, guys, if you would only, the focus sometimes is so narrow is the problem. If they could widen the aperture ever so slightly and see what, again, other reports that are being published almost simultaneously are indicating, it might give them a different and maybe a clearer picture, too, of the past.
That's exactly right, and it is frustrating to see some of the papers, but it can kind of be fun from somebody with our perspective. You can read a lot of, well, I wouldn't call it mundane science, but science that isn't quite as exciting as our subject, and see in the paper that the exciting thing was happened. It just wasn't taken into consideration in the report of their evidence. So the catastrophism actually solves a lot of things that are considered a mystery or misinterpreted with theories that just are very difficult to withstand any kind of scrutiny, including the overkill hypothesis that says that those early paleo Indians were somehow within 200 years. We know they populated the northern hemisphere from Seattle to Miami to southern Chile, but I do think it is unlikely. That's well understood and accepted, but I think it's very, very unlikely that they were able to accomplish the great extinction that they're charged with, and able to take more than 200 different species of animals and hunt every single one of them down to its last individual so that none remain extant today. That's a little implausible for me. Remember, some of those were one-ton armadillos, and people don't eat a lot of armadillos now, and I bet when they're a ton, you even stay further away from them.
That's a good point. I'll tell you something else that we talked about over the weekend. We were with Dr. Christopher Moore, and I said to him, Dr. Moore, would you contend that there were more people that existed in the woodland period, much later than the Paleo-Indian period? He said, well, yeah, there would be. And I said, would you also contend that, that they were hunting a lot of white-tailed deer? And he said, oh, absolutely. That was the main thing that they were hunting. And I said, well, here's a question. And also, one of the things we were discussing was that blood protein analysis of points from that period shows what they were hunting. And I said, well, would you agree then that if there were more people existing and that they were all hunting these white-tailed deer, that it's curious that they weren't all hunted to death or made extinct as well? And he goes, that's a really good point. And that's the whole thing is, again, in the Paleo-Indian period, it seems that there were fewer people, and they were hunting much larger and resilient animals, and yet we don't see the same sort of effect on later population species by people when there are a lot more of them hunting. And so, again, I think the questions we have to raise logically are, how likely is it that humans alone could have done this? That overkill hypothesis you're talking about, when especially there's evidence of other factors that may have been at play. Listen, George, I know you got to catch a flight, but really quickly, I'll ask you, what's next for you in Cosmic Tusk?
Well, we got some upcoming stuff that we'll be publishing. It's easy when they publish the papers because I just hoist the paper and maybe say a few words about it, but we got plenty of that stuff coming. I don't know what's going to come out of left field, but I know there's a paper underway now to further refine and refute one of the criticisms of the discovery of archaeological evidence in Syria. It's some of the earliest agricultural settlements, indeed the earliest agricultural settlement, or at least the best studied, in Abu Huraira, Syria. Mm-hmm. And I'll withhold some of the details, but they have refined the evidence from there very carefully, and it's pretty clear that this event coincided with the very, 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 or shortly before, the first agriculturalists in the world. So that's going to be an exciting paper, and will confirm the Asia influence of the comet impact, be it over there or more distant than there.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, Mike, and then other things coming up on the TUS should include hopefully some more information from the Hiawatha team. I think there's probably some papers underway there, and this is just my maybe perhaps wishful thinking, but I'm just going to give you a guess right now that sometime in the next few months, or at least before the end of the year, we'll see some evidence from them that the crater is unusually warm, and that would be remnant heat from the impact. And they suggest that at a couple of places very slyly in the current information that the stream that's coming out from under Hiawatha that they obtained their samples from maybe shouldn't be there given the characteristics of melting around there. Now, we know that Greenland is melting perhaps more than we'd like, but they know a whole lot about the characteristics of that melt and what volumes there should be. And it seems to me, and in fact, like I say, they seem to have slyly hinted a few times, that 20-mile-wide area that, remember, at one time, and we think is perhaps as recently as 13,000 years ago, would have been a molten bowl of rock. Well, when that solidifies, it retains a lot of legacy heat to it, probably for thousands and thousands of years. That may still be detectable, and it may even be melting the ice above it. So I'll take a flyer and predict that perhaps that'll be revealed in the coming year. But there's always something. About every 4 to 6 weeks, there's another blockbuster on this subject, and I hope people will come to the Cosmic Dusk and follow it with us there.
Hey, I'm happy to see what the outcome is, whatever that may be, but I'm sure enjoying being on the ride. So, George Howard, I know you feel the same. It's always great to have you on. And, my man, we'll check in with you again real soon. Safe travels out there, okay?
Well, it's a pleasure to join you on the Graylian Report, and I love all your podcasts, Mikey. You do a terrific job as a science communicator, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, my friend, and of course, we will have you back. That's George Howard, a bit of a traveling man, and in fact, he had an op-ed in The Hill today entitled A Lesson from Louisiana Saving Coastal Communities. You can check that out online. I will tweet that. And of course, we'll be sure and have him back with some more updates on our mutual interest on this program. And we'll be wrapping things up after this break. When we return, I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report, and we will be right back. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Once again, thanks to George Howard for jumping on the mic and discussing some of our mutual interest in this ancient mystery, the Younger Dryas. We talk about it a lot on this program and, of course, on all the related properties, which include the Seven Ages Audio Journal, where George has been a guest in the past. And I would reference that episode. If you go to sevenages.org, you can dig through the back catalog. Of course, the podcast is available on iTunes as well. And we did a whole lengthy episode that looks more, I think, in the broader sense, at the Younger Dryas. And George did an exemplary job communicating about that on that episode. But another guy who does that, and we mentioned him a good bit during our conversation, is James P. Kennett. And we referenced the article that appeared at The Current, which is published by UC Santa Barbara, during our discussion. And that article was titled The Day the World Burned. And they discussed geologic and paleontological evidence unearthed in southern Chile via this paper that we were talking about, which supports the theory that a major cosmic impact event occurred around 12,800 years ago. Now, Sonia Fernandez wrote this piece, and it features Dr. Kennett's work. I want to share a little of that with you here. She writes, "When UC Santa Barbara geology professor emeritus James Kennett and colleagues set out years ago to examine signs of a major cosmic impact that occurred toward the end of the Pleistocene epoch, little did they know just how far-reaching the projected climatic effect would be. It's much more extreme than I ever thought when I started this work," Kennett noted. The more work that has been done, the more extreme it seems. He's talking about the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, which postulates that a fragmented comet slammed into the Earth close to 12,800 years ago, causing rapid climate changes, megafaunal extinctions, sudden human population decrease, and cultural shifts, and widespread wildfires, or biomass burning. The hypothesis suggests a possible triggering mechanism for the abrupt changes in climate at that time, in particular a rapid cooling in the northern hemisphere called the Younger Dryas, amid a general global trend of natural warming and ice sheet melting evidenced by changes in the fossil and sediment record. Controversial from the time that it was proposed, the hypothesis even now continues to be contested by those who prefer to attribute the end Pleistocene reversal and warming entirely to terrestrial causes. But Kennett and fellow stalwarts of the Younger Dryas Boundary Impact Hypothesis, as it is also known, have recently received a major boost. the discovery of a very young 31-kilometer-wide impact crater beneath the Greenland ice sheet, which they believe may have been one of the many comet fragments that impacted Earth at the onset of the Younger Dryas. Now, in a paper published in the journal Nature Scientific Reports, Kennett and colleagues, led by the Chilean paleontologist Mario Pino, present further evidence of a cosmic impact, this time far south of the equator, that likely led to biomass burning, climate change, and megafaunal extinctions nearly 13,000 years ago. And I want to leave off with one quote here from Kennett. He said, "We have identified the YDB layer at high latitudes in the southern hemisphere at near 41 degrees south, close to the tip of South America. This is a major expansion of the extent of the YDB event, and of course the vast majority of the evidence up until this time had been found in the northern hemisphere." But they go on to quote Kennett here about some of the minutiae. And he says, "Because the sequencing of these events looked like what had already been described in the YDB papers in North America and Western Europe, the group decided to run analyses of impact-related proxies in search of the YDB layer. And this, of course, yielded the presence of microscopic spherules, interpreted to have been formed by melting due to the extremely high temperatures associated with the impact. The layer containing these spherules also shows peak concentrations of platinum and gold and native iron particles rarely found in nature." Now, if you recall back a few weeks when I had Randall Carlson on the program, we discussed those spherules, and that's one of the many indicators that they've been finding in this so-called YDB layer. But Kennett goes on to say, "Among the most important spherules are those that are chromium-rich, and that's because chromium is in abundance there in the Pilauco site, but they don't find those in the northern hemisphere. And so, as Kennett says, it turns out that volcanic rocks in the southern Andes can be rich in chromium, and these rocks provided a local source for this chromium. And thus, the cometary objects must have hit South America as well." I mean, we're seeing science at work right here, and this is a fascinating process. And I'm still willing to say that there's still science that must be done before we can draw a definitive conclusion. And although a lot of this goes back to the scientists Richard Firestone and William Topping, and I've been following their research for more than a decade, I mean, going back years, and that, of course, well in advance of even having knowledge, personally, of the Younger Dryas, here were two scientists publishing in an obscure journal I'd never heard of called Mammoth Tusk about what they believe was evidence for a cosmic event in Paleo-Indian times, and I probably didn't even know what all that meant. But I was fascinated that they were using science to try and determine widespread changes in the climate and other things that may have been happening in the ancient world. And then when I meet Randall Carlson, I begin working with the Seven Ages guys. We begin working with the archaeological community in the Southeast, and we begin to see the pieces of this puzzle falling together. And again, spending time with people who have been the co-authors on some of these papers and getting their feedback, that has been the key. Because when I'm speaking with people who are far more invested in this and far more scientifically literate than yours truly, who are saying, "Look, here is why this is significant. This is what we found and why it's important." And the accumulation of evidence is getting to a point where it is more difficult for us to dispute it. That is interesting to me. I think that we are really on the cusp of a remarkable discovery right now, and these are certainly interesting times to live in, which is, in truth, why it troubles me a bit that there are some in the scientific community who are willing to say that this has already been debunked, that there's no need for additional evidence because we can already debunk the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. If information forthcoming continues to make the case for it, will those scientists continue to turn their backs and act as though there's nothing more to see here based solely on the evidence that's been offered to the contrary in the past? At some point, we may have to change our minds, especially if further evidence continues to point to a different conclusion than the ones that we once made. As a good scientist, you must look at all the evidence, and there's an awful lot of it right now. That'll have to be the final word for this week's edition of the Graylian Report. Thanks to all you guys out there who continue to support our work, and to George Howard for joining us. And on behalf of all of us at Graylian International, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Race and Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrail, James Waldo, Tiffany Mack, the lovely assistant Lauren, the Graylian Reverend, and yours truly, I remain Micah Hanks. We will catch you guys again next week on the Graylian Report. And as always, stay strange out there.